Welcome to the Democracy Dispatch podcast. I'm Justin Marsh, political director at Vermont Conservation Voters. This is your weekly scoop on legislative action as we work to push forward environmental policies for Vermont. Each Monday, we will take a look back at the week prior, preview the week ahead, and speak with legislators and advocates on topics affecting our air, water, open space, and quality of life. On today's episode, I will be joined by our 2024 legislative intern, Cora Smith. We will have a conversation about her role and the interests that emerged while spending hours reporting on committee discussions over the past 3 months. Later, she'll take the wheel as host for an interview with Kathy Beyer, Senior Vice President for Real Estate Development at Evernorth, an organization with offices across northern New England that have developed and financed environmentally, socially, and economically responsible projects for low and moderate income people. The two discuss Act 250's role in allowing affordable housing and also unpack just how affordable housing is created and defined. Before that, we hear from Representative Jonathan Williams of Berry City, who discusses the response, recovery, and resilience measures needed for communities impacted by flooding. The conversation highlights bills S310 and S213 as important steps toward flood safety and management. But first, I want to bring Lauren Hurl, Executive Director of Vermont Conservation Voters, into the fold for our session shakedown segment, where we recap the last week in the State House and give a preview of what is in store. Last Tuesday, we saw another roll call vote on S259, Make Big Oil Pay, a bill that would establish a Climate Superfund Act, holding fossil fuel companies accountable for the damage their products inflict due to the negative impacts on the environment. And how did that vote look?
Yeah, it was a really impressive 26-3 vote. Great to see tripartisan support for that initiative and just really gave it great momentum heading over to the House for their committees to start considering the bill. So that was really exciting to see.
And the House Committee on Human Services voted S-25 out of committee on Friday on a unanimous vote of 11-0. There was a lot of action in that committee this week around that bill. What is ultimately included and where did it land?
So that committee did some great work. And so they took the bill that the Senate had passed last year that banned a suite of toxic chemicals from personal care products, including cosmetics and lotions and things like that. They added a couple additional chemicals to that list of what would be restricted, so some additional toxic chemicals. So that was a great improvement the House made. The Senate had also sent over banning PFAS from textiles and artificial turf, which the committee maintained in the House. They also added banning PFAS from children's products, so products marketed at kids 12 and under, and also cookware, so your Teflon pans. So it was just great to see that the bill got strengthened in a couple great ways. And so, and then seeing the unanimous vote for it puts us in good position for a floor vote next week.
Awesome. Yeah. And as the Senate bills switch over to the House and the House bills over to the Senate, what has been taken up so far in committees?
The Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee has been pretty much solely focused on H-687, the Act 250 modernization bill. So they've been looking at that and kind of parallel looking at S-311, which the Senate Economic Development Committee had passed a few weeks ago. So I'm assuming that some key pieces from S-311 will get melded into the Act 250 modernization pieces that passed the House. And so that's where their focus has been. That committee, Senate Natural Resources, also has the Renewable Energy Standard bill in their committee. They haven't started acting on it, but we're anticipating that in the next week or two, they will get working on that bill as well.
Great. And you had a conversation with Representative Jonathan Williams about S-213 and S-310.
Yeah, so this bill obviously has been a huge priority coming out of the flooding last summer. Representative Williams, as one of the legislators from a really heavily impacted community from last summer's flooding, there were a whole suite of initiatives. So I was able to catch up with Representative Williams to hear about that kind of broad slate of ideas and policies that were brought in, and S-213, the Flood Safety Act, looking at how we manage our watersheds to reduce flood risk was one of those priorities, and the House Environment and Energy Committee's already working on that diligently. So why don't we go hear more from Representative Williams on kind of flood initiatives that are underway.
I am so happy to be joined here today with Representative Jonathan Williams, who is from Barrie, which of course was one of the most impacted communities in last summer's flooding. And I'm really excited to talk to him because he came in this session and ever since the flood has been working so hard for his community and has been a real leader on looking at what are response, recovery, and resilience measures that the state can take to help the impacted communities and prevent this kind of thing in the future. So I wanted to open it up to you, Representative, to just share what were your hopes coming into this session?
Thank you, Lauren. This session coming in really wanted to focus on assisting those members of my community and across the state who were impacted by the summer floods. We've had three 100-year storms in the past decade. A little more than a decade. And, you know, that is evidence to me that our climate is changing and changing rapidly. People in my community, an eighth of the grand list was impacted. And unfortunately, people in Barrie City lost their homes. And in one instance, there was a loss of life. And so we really need to make sure that people are made whole, that our community is made whole, that the 107 communities that were flooded are able to receive assistance from the state, and that we're better prepared for flooding events in the future, because it is going to happen again. And unfortunately, the storms will be more severe and more impactful. So we need to be prepared.
Absolutely. So I know taking those goals, you and some colleagues had introduced legislation at the start of the session, a kind of omnibus flood package. Now a number of pieces of that are moving in different vehicles, different bills, the budget, and so on. So what are some of the key pieces that you're really prioritizing and kind of where do they stand now?
Absolutely. Well, a couple of pieces of the Flood Recovery Omnibus Bill 723 have already been enacted, and that includes assisting municipalities with lost revenues from abated properties. When a homeowner's property is flooded, they can't pay taxes, so the town forgives their taxes. But unfortunately, that impacts municipal revenues, which again, or in turn affects the ability to provide essential services. So Barrie and Montpelier in particular experienced severe loss of revenue, and we were able to address that through the Budget Adjustment Act in FY24 BAA based on a revenue that assisted quite a few towns. And so that was a piece of it. We were looking at across various bills that are moving in the State House. We're looking at things like disclosures of flooded properties for renters and sellers of property to potential renters, landlords to potential renters and or sellers to buyers. So does this property exist in a floodplain? Has it been flooded in the past? What are the risks? So that's a piece of it. We're looking at increased planning for the regional planning commissions, dam safety, watershed studies. We're trying to address this holistically, and I'm not a huge fan of that term. It's kind of a buzzword, but we are trying to look at this from every angle and see how can we harden our infrastructure and be better prepared for future flooding events. There's a lot. S-310 is a really great bill that the Senate just passed over to the House, and I'm hoping we'll move that expeditiously. It incorporates quite a few things, too many to list here, but really takes a look at flood safety from on a watershed level, because as we keep hearing, floodwaters don't really care about town lines, and so we have to look at it more from a higher level than just municipal boundaries.
Absolutely. Yeah, and another one we've been following is S213, that is the watershed management pieces.
Yes. You know,
how are we dealing with our river corridors, our wetlands, and our dams to minimize future flood risk? So that one, as our listeners probably know, passed the Senate and is now, they're already working on it in House Environment and Energy, which is exciting too.
Absolutely. 213 and 310 are very complementary.
Absolutely.
And yep. Elements were featured in our omnibus bill, and we're happy to see them just to keep moving. You know, I'd like to see increased supports for businesses and nonprofits that were flooded. We had the BGAP program over the summer, and that was $20 million and did quite a bit. But, you know, I'd like to see more. We're also looking at the Senate, I believe, is now that it has the FY25 budget, is looking at contingent funding for home remediation, raising homes of homeowners that were flooded out so they can continue to live in flood-prone areas, just are better prepared in the future. That's $3.5 million in the budget for that. Hoping we can get more, because that number is just sourced from Barry and Montpelier's needs. And really, there were homes across the state that are in similar straits. So, there's a lot more to do, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, well, again, I'm just really grateful having people like you who did the work to think through, okay, how do we turn kind of ideas and needs of our communities into policy action? It takes a lot of work. So really grateful for all you and some of your colleagues have been doing. And I'm excited to see what we can get done this year for people and kind of keep attention on this critical issue. So thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
All right. I'll see you soon. Take care.
That was Barrie City Representative Jonathan Williams. I'm joined now with Cora Smith, who has been serving as a shared legislative intern this year between Vermont Conservation Voters, Vermont Natural Resources Council, and the Vermont Planners Association. In her role, she attends legislative committee meetings when our priority policies are being discussed and tracks their progress, reporting daily to each of the organizations that she serves. She spoke with Sabina Haskell and Peter Gill, Chair and Executive Director of the Natural Resources Board, respectively, to help frame and give important context for her interview with Kathy Beyer, the Senior Vice President for Real Estate Development at Evernorth. So, Cora, you've been learning lots about how Act 250 this year, how it influences housing development, and you've obviously been in so many committee discussions. You probably know more about Act 250 than most legislators do. But what actually got you interested in this topic?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, Justin. It's good to be here. So like you said, I've been tracking three different bills that are proposed modernizing Act 250 this session. And I've been really fascinated with the rhetoric of sort of housing versus conservation and how they're always a lot of times seen as rivals. Obviously, we know Vermont is in a housing crisis and climate change is impacting our state more and more. But I think it's possible to address both of these crises. And so I just wanted to dive more into that.
Yeah. So zooming out a bit, what does the housing crisis look like across the country?
Yeah. So across the U.S., there's just not enough housing supply for the rising demand. Rent's also increasing every year. According to the Pew Research Center, the average rent across the U.S. has risen 18% between 2017 and 2022. And this disproportionately impacts marginalized groups. Younger Americans and Black and Hispanic Americans are more likely to be renters.
And so what does the housing landscape look like for us here in Vermont?
Great question. So yeah, Vermont's, again, facing a shortage of availability and affordability, like similar to the country. We have the second highest rate of homelessness compared to our population. And this, our statewide rental vacancy rates, there are below 5%, which is the threshold that's considered to be a healthy vacancy rate. And, you know, there's a range of potential culprits. There's, you know, the growing number of people moving to Vermont since the pandemic, more short-term rentals, increasing rent, and there's just simply not enough housing to house Vermonters. But Act 250 is often seen as sort of used as a punching bag by a lot of legislators on both sides of the aisle and a lot of advocates. And so throughout the session, I've just been wondering, you know, is Act 250 this silver bullet to address our housing crisis, or is it just one piece of a much bigger puzzle?
Yeah, I'm excited to have you figure that one out.
Me too.
Golden question, right? I wish it was just as easy as one podcast episode solved.
Me too. That would be great.
So how does Act 250 play a role in our housing development?
Yeah, so when a developer runs to build 10 or more units of housing within a 5-mile radius, they'll trigger Act 250, which means they have to obtain an Act 250 permit. And so a lot of housing developers don't want to go through this permitting process because it can be long and expensive. And some developers end up building less units of housing to avoid triggering Act 250 altogether. And so that is contributing to sprawl across the state. So again, I just wanted to see how Act 250 regulations actually influence housing development in the state. And so to learn more about this, I spoke with Kathy Beyer to learn more about the issue. Kathy works at Evernorth, and she's served in the Vermont legislature and is on the board of directors for VNRC.
Awesome. Well, let's hear that conversation now. And thanks so much for being my guest interview. This is the first time we've ever had someone else do the main interview, except for, little old me. So I really appreciate you taking, obviously, for all your work you did this session. And then also for, wanting to do this as a fun little side project.
Totally. Thanks for having me on the show. And yeah, it'll be fun to interview Kathy. And it's been great to talk to you.
Well, let's listen to that now.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hi, Cora.
It's good to have you. So could you just start off by telling listeners about Evernorth a little bit and what your role is in creating and supporting affordable housing development?
Yeah, thanks. Evernorth has actually been around for 35 years, and we've been building affordable, mostly rental housing in every corner of the state. Over our history, we have either constructed or renovated over 7,000 apartments. So we have a long history in doing this. And my role is vice president of real estate development. I have a fantastic team of 10 individuals who are well-versed in both real estate developers and project managers who are experts in construction.
Awesome. Thank you for that.
But I want to add, we always partner in every project we do. We always partner with what we call a local partner, which is, for example, Champlain Housing Trust in the Burlington area or Wyndham and Windsor Housing Trust in the Brattleboro area. So we are always working with a regional partner.
That's great to hear. Yeah, so I saw you recently wrote an op-ed for VT Digger. It's called The Raised Ranch. I was curious if you could talk a little bit about that and how it outlines our state's housing crisis.
Yeah, well, we need to build 30,000 new units by 2030, right? That's the number. And Vermont has made a major investment in housing over the past 3 years through ARPA funds. Unfortunately, it also comes at a time I have never seen construction prices increase as fast as they have done in the last 4 years, and well over a 30% increase just over the last 2 years. So my article about the raised ranch, which is kind of this ubiquitous type of a very simple, great starter home, right? You find them in every community, and they're usually about 1,200 square feet. And everybody thinks like, oh, I could build that for $200,000. No problem. And you can't. Construction prices have increased so dramatically that lovely little starter home that we used to think, oh, yeah, $200,000, it's like $425,000. That's a starter home now. And so no wonder we're finding and that's at the, that's at the home ownership moderate income level, completely leaves behind people at the lower income, at the lower scale of incomes, who really cannot get into home ownership and rental is their only opportunity.
Totally. Well, thank you for that framing. That's really helpful. I was curious too, what does affordable housing look like across the state, the need for it, and what actually counts as affordable?
Yeah. It's a nationwide standard, longstanding, that no one to be affordable, you shouldn't be paying more than 30% of your income towards either rent or your mortgage payment and insurance. And so that, you know, depending on your income level, that may not be a problem, but for many of our households, it's increasingly become a problem what we call people are rent burden or severely rent burden. So when the work we do, and I'm trying to stay away from terms that not a lot of people understand, like 60% of median income is our target audience, is where we target our work. But mm-hmm. just to turn that into something more meaningful, that we are really trying to house people meeting that affordable rent level who are earning under $18 to $25 an hour. So, and you know, some people are up at that, and some people are quite a bit below that. For example, our minimum wage is $13.67 an hour, and I can tell you, someone making minimum wage in Vermont is likely severely rent burdened because it's not enough money to pay the current rents.
Totally, yeah, that makes sense. Thank you for that too. And I was wondering if you could dive a little bit more into priority housing projects. It's been a big topic in the legislature this session, and what that means, and then do they encourage housing development, and have they been forever known?
Yes, priority. We have used priority housing projects for several years, and they are a very good tool for not only encouraging, including affordable housing, say in a larger development, but also, and we can talk separately about why a housing developer might benefit from an exemption from Act 250. What we've seen with priority housing projects, and a great example is right in Montpelier, Taylor Street, which is a multimodal transit center on the bottom and 30 apartments above it. Now, that is a priority housing project that did not have to go through Act 250. In some cases, and this has happened more than once, you might have a larger master development of, say, 100 units, and undertaken by a private developer, and they realize, oh, my entire 100-unit master development will be exempt from Act 250 if I include a priority housing project. So you meet the definition of a priority housing project, and often they will come to us and say, hey, would you like to build a building in our larger development that meets the priority housing project definition? And we're like, yeah, that'd be great. So that's one example of where priority projects have been helpful. And then the other side is really leads to the exemptions that are now in being discussed by the legislature in H-687 and S-311, where we would actually have complete exemption from Act 250 in Tier 1 areas, Tier 1A, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, you completely erase the concept of priority housing projects, right? Because there's no Act 250 jurisdiction, so you don't need a priority housing project. I would say as little as 3 or 4 years ago, I had concerns about that just because the priority housing project has been a tool for us. But I was on the NRB steering committee and working with that group. I really got to the point where I do believe the time is right in Vermont. We do a careful job of crafting the definition and how you become a Tier 1A area that an exemption from Act 250 is appropriate. And then that has the benefit, right? If we're going to do 30,000 more, so we need 30,000 new homes. It needs to be homes of all different sizes and at all different income levels, right? It can't be all single family home ownership. It can't be all multifamily housing. We need all of it. And I think that lines up nicely with the goals of H-687.
Yeah, thank you for that segue into H-687. that's great. So I guess Would you say that those exemptions are will encourage more housing to be developed and will encourage developers to, again, if they want to maybe avoid Act 250, will they be able to build more because of these exemptions?
You know, I mean, and I want to be the first to say that, you know, Act 250 is not the reason we have a housing crisis. Providing an exemption does a couple of things. There are private developers out there who I've seen it in my years of doing this work, where a private developer chooses to build 9 units mm-hmm. only to stay out of Act 250.
Gotcha.
Right or wrong, that's what they're doing. So yes, I think there are smaller private developers who will decide, won't make their decision on density based on staying out of Act 250. For the larger developers such as Evernorth, the needing an Act 250 permit adds to both the cost and the time, and it will help us to build faster and reduce cost. And that's no, you know, that's no, like, I'm not trying to castigize or, you know, negative about Act 250. It's just how long the permit process takes. And for us and other developers, when you are still not completely vested in your permits, when there's still the possibility that somebody could appeal your Act 250 permit, you pace your pre-development spending. I mean, nobody wants to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars only to get appealed, which has happened. Unfortunately, Evernorth has examples of that. So it not only will speed, you know, could knock easily 4 to 6 months out of the getting to construction. It's going to reduce the cost. The Act 250 application fee on its own is approaching almost $2,000 a unit because it's based on construction cost, and construction costs are so high. Mm-hmm. And it removes one of these uncertainties about another appeal. I mean, I think a lot of people have heard about our project in Putney, 25 units located across from the Putney Food Co-op. I think it's a great location in a NDA. So it is a priority housing project exempt from Act 250. And we were appealed first on the local permit, which we went all the way to the Vermont Supreme Court. And then we needed to get an amended jurisdictional opinion that it confirmed we were a priority housing project. And that JO was appealed. And we prevailed. A month ago, we got the very solid decision, and we've been appealed to the Supreme Court. 25 people, 25 households would be moving into their apartments today if we had if we didn't have to go through that second appeal.
Wow, that is so frustrating. I'm sure this you watch that project the timeline, but yeah, I guess then just going off of that, are there ways that could make the Act 250 process more streamlined and so that you're not dealing with all of these appeals?
You know, Vermont has a tradition. It's in statute. This is who can appeal, right? This is who has party status. And it's easy for me as a housing developer to, you know, say, oh, that person is just appealing because they're NIMBYism, or, you know, choose your reason, but they have the right to appeal. Mm-hmm. And unless we want to change that, which I don't think there's a lot of legislative appetite for that, what I would say is that it shouldn't take a year to get to resolution on an appeal. And perhaps we need to prioritize affordable housing projects that are get appealed, or change the structure. You know, right now we're environmental court, which is a very legalistic process. Maybe this the concept of H-687 using the newly created environmental board will be helpful, but we need to stop doing what we have been doing, you know, for over the last 10, I mean, I think it's been 15 years, perhaps. No. Mm-hmm. I don't have the answer, but we're doing a disservice to really the people who need the housing.
Certainly. Well, I appreciate that. And I just wanted to circle back to your op-ed a little bit. I've been thinking about the housing world sort of outside of Act 250. It seems like Act 250 is a piece of the puzzle, but like you said, it might not solve the housing crisis. So I was curious, what other steps can the legislature take to increase or at least incentivize affordable housing development and housing development in general across the state?
I mean, I thought last year's effort was really remarkable. That, I mean, 5 years ago, you told me that we're going to pass legislation that says all zoning that permits single family homes is going to permit duplexes. And if you're on water and sewer, you're going to permit quadplexes. I would have said, not a chance. And It was widely supported and it is being implemented by the towns. Another thing that helps us is the parking requirements. I just was looking at a 24 unit project where the town still had two parking spaces per unit. And this was for senior housing, you know, like they don't have, some of them don't have cars. And you think like, oh, what's the big deal? And it's like parking lots take up a lot of space. And oh, by the way, we also have this water quality issue. So we want to reduce our impervious surface. So, you know, I think that was a real step forward. But one area is really, I mean, maybe that's why, you know, this podcast is important or have these kind of discussions, is if we need 30,000 new homes in Vermont, change is going to come to your neighborhood. You know, it's not going to look the same. And there's still resistance to multifamily housing, whether it's in large, you know, add to that affordable multifamily housing, and there's resistance. But yeah, we need to be having people. My friends complain. My kids can't afford to buy a home here. Well, when you say that, then you have to say, well, maybe it would be okay to have more density in my community, in my neighborhood. And, you know, we are not going to solve this housing crisis by building 30,000 single family homes. So that means we're going to have some change to the fabric of our communities, which I think can be a positive thing, right? Like,
definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. I was curious if you had any other messages you want to leave with listeners today before we go.
I think it is that kind of message of how we are talking about the need to be. I love this quote. Heather McGee wrote a book called The Sum of Us, and she calls it the sharing enough economy, right? And that we are in a time and a space where, I'm going to get philosophical on you now, that and particularly Vermont is not this kind of place. This is kind of a zero sum mindset, that actually we are very much a state that takes care of community. And that's the kind of work we need to do if we're going to build a lot more housing.
Definitely. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And thanks so much for coming on the show. And thanks for all you do to house Vermonters. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Cora.
I want to thank our guests, Kathy Beyer, Representative Jonathan Williams, and Lauren Hurl for assisting me. Special thanks to Cora Smith for her work on this episode and throughout the session. She wraps up her time here in Vermont this week and is off to Washington, D.C., where she will begin a new exciting role with Senator Peter Welch. We wish her the best in D.C. and know that she's destined for greatness. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and give us a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media. You can subscribe to our emails, see our legislative environmental scorecard, and learn more about our work and policies by visiting vermontconservationvoters.org. We'll be back next Monday with another new episode. Until then, thanks for listening.